Good morning from Northern California. I am now here to read you another chapter or more of Emily Carr, Growing Pains, the autobiography of Emily Carr. How appropriate. The title of the chapter is Green. And those of you who are following me on Lemur have already heard my rejection slip noticed about my green painting that I submitted into a show, five different pieces into a show, and was rejected because there was more than 5,000 people, I guess, that in subject, whatever, however many people. It's hard in the art world, and I remember feeling very good about myself after getting chosen last year in something that was about that big with submissions. So I guess I need to just not be so disappointed, but I did have some good paintings putting into this show that dealt with the theme, and it was green. The theme was green. And now that is the title of this chapter, and we're at page 314 of the book. Woods are, let's start again, green. Woods, you are very sly, picking these moments or picking those moments when you are quiet and off guard to reveal yourselves to us, folding us into your calm, accepting us to the sway, the rhythm of your spaces, space interwoven with the calm that rests forever in you. For all that you stand so firmly rooted, so still, you quiver. There is movement in every leaf. Woods, you are not only a group of trees. Rather, you are low space intertwined with growth. Bless John Whitley. Bless Algernon Talmadge. Algernon. Sorry, I don't know. I know I've come across that name before. I am blanking on who it is. The two painting masters who first pointed out to me, raw young pupil that I was, that there was coming and going among trees, that there was sunlight in shadows. I love this. This is so appropriate for where I am right today. Okay, the next paragraph. In the roof peak of the apartment house I built was a little attic room, my favorite of all the rooms in that house. A crooked stair led to it. The stair was in the corner of the studio. I chose this room with its wide view for my bedroom. It had low drooped walls, but the center of the room was high. Its end walls were peaked. The naked ridge pole and studding showed because the room was unlined. Rain pattered on the cedar shingles only a few feet above my face. In its west end wall, the room had two large windows which appeared to be narrow because they were so high, beginning at the floor and ending right in the point of the gable. These windows let in an extensive view, a view of housetops, trees, sea, purple mountains, and sky. The view seemed to come companionably into the room rather than to draw me out. And it had an additional glory. But for this glory, you must look out, look down. Then you saw right into the heart of a great western maple tree. Its huge bole culminated in widespread stout branches. There was room for immense life in this bole. The maple tree was always beautiful, always gracious. In spring, it had a sunlit, pale yellow glory. In summer, it was deep, restful, green. In autumn, it was gold and bronze. In winter, It was a gnarled network of branches. It was in winter you saw best the tree's reality, its buildup and strength. Oh, this is such a fabulous chapter so far. I love this. That paragraph there, let me read that again. The maple tree was always beautiful, always gracious. In spring, it had a sunlit pale yellow glory. In summer, it was deep, restful green. In autumn, it was gold and bronze. In winter, it was a gnarled network of branches. It was in winter you saw best the tree's reality, its buildup and strength. So true. On the whitewashed underside of the roof shingles of my attic room, I painted two immense totem Indian eagles. Gosh, I'm not really looking at the words today. Their outstretched wings covered the entire ceiling. They were brave birds, powerful of beak and talon. Their plumage was indicated in the Indian way, a few carefully studied feathers painted on a wing. Breast and tail gave the impression that the bird was fully plumed. Sleeping beneath these two birds, these two strong birds, the stout western maple tree beneath my window, is it wonder that I should have strong dreams, dreams that folded me very close? One night I had a dream of greenery. I never attacked the painting of growing foliage. Quite the same after that dream, I think. Growing green had become something different to me. In my dream, I saw a wooded hillside, an ordinary slope such as one might see along any western roadside. Tree-covered, normal, no particular pattern, or designed to catch an artist's eye. Were he seeking subject matter? But in my dream, that hillside suddenly lived, weighted with sap, burning grief, burning green in every leaf, every scrap of it vital. Woods that had always meant so much to me from that moment meant just so much more. Chapter is called Alternative. Ladies approaching 70 must not expect to work like girls of 17. It is unreasonable. I'm not approaching 70, but that just so tickles me. Ladies approaching 70 must not expect to work like girls of 17. It is unreasonable. That's a quote. The doctor's voice was reproving, but kindly. Overdoing has enraged your heart. To begin with, we will see what a good long rest in hospital will do. Now, those of you that have been following this story from the start, she's had some issues with being sick quite a bit throughout the book. So, anyway. She says here, how long? The doctor resorted to a professional shrug and the spreading of his palms. The doctor, another thing, he paused. His eyes roved round my studio, finally resting contemplatively, on a small monkey and a mother dog and her four pups on the hearth rug. I notice you have an aviary of birds on the veranda, he mused. Livestock entails work. You must limit yourself now to a minimum of exertion. Throw everything not imperatively necessary overboard. Goodness, you have done a lot of work. Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to go off on a little bit on this. I feel like that's what the universe is telling me to. It's like, get rid of this stuff. You know, I don't need this anymore. I don't need any of it. Oh, holy moly. Okay, back to the text. Sorry, I don't want to make this very long. All right. Goodness, you have done a lot of work. His eyes roved from my menagerie to my full canvas racks. My breath caught. Not half what I want to do, Doctor. You don't mean you are not telling me my painting days are done? Oh, lovely. All alone caravan days in the quiet woodsy camps with my creatures. 70 isn't so frightfully old. We will talk of that after we see what rest does for that heart. Meantime, take things very, very easy. I will engage a room in the hospital for you. One thing's certain. Trips alone must be given up. Oh, ugh, my stupid heart needs a chaperone. No, thank you. I will stay at home. I never could work with danglers hanging around. The weeks in hospital sauntered slowly by till Eric Newton, noted art critic for the Manchester Guardian, paid a visit to the West. Eric Brown, director of Ottawa National Gallery, had asked Mr. Newton while out west to select some 15 pictures of mine and ship east. Well, see, she's already famous already, but whatever. He had prospective buyers. Mr. Newton wired me from Vancouver. Finding I was in hospital, he came there to see me. He said, as I drove over the island highway, I saw Emily Carr pictures in the woods, no matter in which direction I looked. You have caught the Western spirit. Folding his hand over my two sick ones, he added, get better. These hands are too clever to lie idle. I turned my face away. What good getting better? What good getting better if I was never to roam the woods again? Paint sack on shoulder, dog at heel. Wah, wah, wah. The maternity ward was across the court from my room. Or wah, wah, wah. Newborns were taking the unknown life before them hard. Oh, the price of being was just... Sorry, the price of being was this adjusting ourselves to life at different angles. You see that again. The price of being was this adjusting ourselves to life at different angles. I blinked hard a time or two and turned back to Mr. Newton. All right, I'll try to get well. When Lauren Harris advised me, put aside the Indian motifs. Strike out for yourself, Emily, inventing, creating clothing ideas born of this West, ideas that you feel deep-rooted in your heart. I sat before the woods and stared, lost, frustrated. I had let myself be bound. It was not handling of paint, but handling of thoughts, which overwhelmed me. Trying to get around this problem, I took always in my sketch sack a little notebook. When I had discovered my subject, I sat before it for some while before I touched a brush, feeling my way into it, asking myself these questions. What attracted you to this particular subject? Oh, this is perfect for me. Why do you paint? Why do you want to paint it? What is its core, the thing you are trying to express? Clearly, and in as few words as possible, I had answered these questions from myself to myself, wording them in my little notebook, presenting essentials only, discarding everything of minor importance. I had found this method very helpful. This saying, in words, as well as in color and form, gave me double approach. I knew nothing about the rules of writing. The only author I'd ever met was Fred Hauser, who wrote A Canadian Art Movement. When I stayed with the Hausers in the East, Fred had let me read two of his manuscripts. He talked with me about them afterwards. When I went home, I wrote an Indian story and sent it to Fred, asking criticism. He liked my story and wrote me a wonderful letter, finding much fault in my construction, taking infinite pains to explain a story's build-up. You do not want eyewash, he wrote and struck hard. The letter made a great impression on me. When I grinned back at Mr. Newton and said, I'll try to get better, I had this idea in the back of my mind. One approach is apparently cut off. I'll try the other. I'll word those things which, during my painting life, have touched me deeply. Doctor, may I write? Write? Write what? Describe places I've seen on my sketching trips. Woods, Indians and things, nice Canadian things of the West, things that will heal, not rile my heart. You can try, but don't get excited. Don't overtire. The nurse was told to watch. She kept bouncing in and grabbing my wrist. She did not approve of the doctor's permission, but had to admit that instead of doing me harm, it soothed and calmed me. I did not know book rules. I made two for myself. They were about the same as the principles I used in painting. Get to the point as directly as you can. Never use a big word if a little one will do. So I wrote the stories that were later to be known as Claywick, reliving those beautiful, calm places among the dear Indians. Their quiet strength healed my heart. Of course, it could not heal old age, but it healed me enough that I could go home and take up that easy life the doctor prescribed. No more was I to go off in my old van alone. That was too strenuous. About that, he was firm. While I was still in the hospital, Eric Brown wrote to me. For a good many years, he had taken interest in and been most helpful about my work. He said my isolation out west was making him think for myself, and it showed in my canvases. I was sending each year to Eastern exhibitions. He now wrote, "Will you collaborate with a biographer? We want the struggle story of your work out west written. Better still, will you write it yourself?" "I don't know how to write," I answered Mr. Brown. "My Indian stories," I had told him about writing them, "are just fun and they're medicine. I go back so vividly on those sketching trips that I forget being sick." I was fond of Eric Brown. He had dug me out of that dreadful slow... I was fond of Eric Brown. He had dug me out of that dreadful slough of despair at the time, when I was too disheartened to paint. I wanted to please him. I said, "Nobody could write my hodgepodge life but me. Biographers can only write up big, important people who have done great deeds to which the public can attach dates. I could not be bothered with collaborators, nor would they be bothered with drab little nothings that have made up my life. However, to please you, Mr. Brown, I will have a try." I had only a few chapters written and was still in the hospital when I got word that Eric Brown was dead. Following close on the news of his death came the death of my Indian friend Sophie, around whom many of my Indian stories were written. Writing as well as painting paused a little inside of me, but soon the easy life began to bore me and I continued the biography. I had two faithful women friends who were very patient in listening to my script, Ruth Humphrey and Flora Burns. It is a tremendous help to hear words with the ears as well as to see them with the eyes. So I read aloud to these friends and received helpful criticism from them. When I had about three chapters of the biography written, I read them to my only surviving relative, a sister. She was very, very angry. She accused me of being disloyal to my family and altogether abominable. It had been absolutely necessary for truth's sake to include a short few pages on our home life, which for me had not been happy after the death of our parents. I had to show what drove me to the woods and to the creatures for comfort, what caused the real starting point of my turn to art. My family had never been in sympathy with my painting, nor entered into my life as an artist. My home life was always a thing entirely apart from my art life. My Indian sketches lay in my bureau drawer. My two friends thought I should endeavor to seek a publisher for them. They suggested I send them to a publishing firm in Toronto. I did so. For months I received no word, good or bad. At last I wrote the publishers and was coolly informed that they had been unable to use the stories, but unfortunately they had lost them. God. They regretted the fact, but there it was. They were lost. I was furious at their indifference and their carelessness. I wrote and wrote, giving them no peace. I wrote to the head and the tail and all the other members of the firm that I could attach a name to. I said, I have no other copy of the manuscript. It is up to you. It must be found. The manuscript remained lost for one whole year. Then it was returned to me. They claimed it had slipped off a desk and fallen among a box of books being packed for Queen's College. If that was the case, why had not Queen's College returned it to the publishers when they unpacked their books, not held it for a year? I am convinced it never would have turned up, but for the unpleasant nagging I gave the entire lot of them. They told me they never were so glad to return anything to anybody. I had tormented them so. I, too, was weary of the nuisance by then. I did not try another publisher. I stuck the manuscript away in the drawer and forgot it. One of the faithful listening ladies who had sat patiently while I read my stories had aloud borrowed them, took them to Vancouver, and showed them to Ira Delworth, one time principal of Victoria High School, later professor of English at the University of British Columbia, and now attached to the CBC at Vancouver. He was interested and said he would like to have some of the stories read over the radio. He came to see me about it. The first series of six readings was done by Dr. G.G. Sedgwick of the University of British Columbia, who had seen some of the work earlier. The second series was read by Mr. Dilworth himself. They pleased the air audience. Shortly after reading the second series, Mr. Dilworth went east, taking with him the manuscript which he showed to his friends, Mr. and Mrs. Clark. On his return from the east, he came to see me. He said, Mr. Clark wants to publish two volumes of your writings, one of the Indian stories and the others of your childhood. Is it possible? I gasped. My one publishing try had been so disastrous. I supposed my stories not up to much as they were so indifferent when they were lost. What about my punctuation and spelling, Mr. Dilworth? They are awful, you know. We can get around that if it is all... That's for sure. I'm sorry to say this about this, but her punctuation in this story even, it's hard to read. Anyway, it's okay. It's been fine. We can get around that if it is all right with you. I shall act as your honorary editor. I can well imagine the relieved oh I gave then. Spelling and punctuation always were such a horrible trial to me, and now here was a genuine professor offering to stand behind me, ready to be appealed to. His kindness lifted a tremendous load from me, just as if he had kicked all the commas, full stops, quotes, and capitals right to another planet. Mr. and Mrs. Clark came west that autumn. Mr. Dilworth brought them to see me. We were to proceed with the work at once. They conferred as to which book should be published first. At first, it seemed in order that it should be the childhood stories. On the other hand, my Indian pictures had been exhibited quite a bit in the East. That would, to some extent, lay a foundation for the Indian stories. It was therefore decided that these should have first place. I cannot describe the terror shakings that overtook me as the stories and I awaited our editor. I felt so shamed, so terrifically ignorant. I wished I had been a better student, that I had not scuttled off to San Francisco Art School, skipping my last year of high. I had heard of Mr. Dilworth as a scholar and a very fine teacher. I should die of shame. We sat down at the table in my studio and alternately read to each other from the script. In 2 seconds, I was not afraid anymore. Two L's there, one's only, one S only, he corrected as we read our new sentence. As we read, or new sentence here, new paragraph there, but he made me feel such things were subservient and secondary importance to the spirit of the text. At once I knew he loved Indians in the West just as I did. My editor never altered my wording arbitrarily. Occasionally he suggested rephrasing a sentence, always explaining why. He never added or omitted anything without consulting me. Sometime he made suggestions, but he made me reword the thought myself. He was a million times younger, a million times cleverer than I, but he never made me feel an old fool, or finished, or stupid, or ignorant. Long before the work on the manuscript was finished, he was just plain I to me. I shall never forget the editing of Claywick, the joy of those hours, nor all it taught me. I was almost sorry to see her finished and shipped off to the publisher. After a while, she came back, a book. And that is the end of Alternative and the end of this reading session. So you have Green and Alternative, and then we are at now page 324, and it looks like the next chapter will be 70th Birthday and a Kiss for Canada. So we are down to the last bit of this book. Let me see if I can, let's see, that's another, so 325 to 332, we have three more chapters, one is only a couple pages. I will do one more reading, it looks like, after the end, and then it will be the finished book. I might do it today and put it up as well, or maybe I'll put it up in a few days. But anyway, we are there. We have been reading this book through, I think I started it through the summer, at the summer. Thank you for being here, and thank you for listening.